Members of the committee. My name is Selena Cunningham. I'm the deputy director in the governor's energy office. And today we're here to tell you a bit about offshore wind. I'm going to start with a brief overview of the main offshore wind initiative and the work underway in the governor's energy office, and then turn it over to the Maine Port Authority and the Department of Environmental Protection to tell you a little bit more about details of their purview. So turning to slide two, as you know, the state has put in place ambitious climate and clean energy statutory requirements, including 80% below 1990 levels for greenhouse gas emission reductions by 2050, and transitioning to clean energy, including an 80% renewable energy portfolio standard requirement by 2030. And earlier this year, the governor announced, directed the governor's energy office to pursue a plan for reaching 100% clean energy by 2040. And in addition to the climate and energy components of this, the clean energy initiative also will produce, we have a goal of 30,000 jobs that we're working to build in the state by 2030. Turning to slide three, the motivation for advancing renewable energy is not only about reducing the emissions associated with electricity, it's also moving away from fossil fuels. Maine is the most heating oil dependent state in the country. 60% of our homes are reliant on fossil fuels compared to the national average of 4%. On the chart on the right, I just want to give you a sense of where our electricity comes from. So this is a image of the ISO New England, which is the regional electricity system here in the New England region. 40% of our electricity comes from natural gas. And over the course of the last two decades, we've transitioned away from coal and oil, but we still are heavily reliant on natural gas. And so we need to transition to new renewable energy, not only to reduce that reliance, but also to help lower the prices of energy over the long term, because natural gas prices are highly volatile and can cause rate increases as we've seen this year. So in 2019, the governor announced the Maine Offshore Wind Initiative to explore how best to advance responsible offshore wind development in the state of Maine. And the governor's energy office, along with other state agencies, have pursued a thoughtful approach to do this through a variety of different focus areas, including planning and stakeholder engagement, which we'll talk about in a little bit more detail. Research and innovation, including pursuing a phased approach to project development in the Gulf of Maine, and then pursuing smart policies, including prioritizing offshore wind in federal waters, so 3 miles and beyond, and then also supporting a state-led research array, which is a proposed project that is before the federal government for review for up to 12 turbines using University of Maine technology, and help us understand not only how to build a domestic and local supply chain to support this industry, but also make sure that we learn how to minimize risks to the environment, to the fishing industry, and do so in a thoughtful way. So, just wanted to let you know, let's see, this is the next slide of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. In addition to the work going on at the state level, the federal government is pursuing commercial offshore wind leases in the Gulf of Maine. They've put forward an ambitious plan to lease 30 gigawatts have 30 gigawatts built by 2030, including a lease sale in the Gulf of Maine in 2040. And this is a multi-year process. We're right now in that red box, and later this week, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management will be in Bangor to hear from Maine stakeholders about their views on leasing areas for offshore wind. So that is an opportunity for stakeholders in the state to discuss the opportunities and challenges associated with offshore wind siting. Moving on to the next slide. To help guide the state's efforts in offshore wind, we launched we went through an 18-month planning process. This was an extensive stakeholder-led effort with funding from the U.S. Economic Development Administration to put forward a data-driven plan about how to responsibly advance offshore wind. And we had nearly 100 public and private experts working on an advisory committee and working groups, focusing on key areas that are important for the growth of this industry, including looking at ports, workforce, supply chain, energy, environment and wildlife, and importantly, the fishing working group. And we were very grateful that the fishing industry, members of the fishing industry, joined this conversation, understanding that, that there is opposition to offshore wind, but we want to make sure that we understand how to advance this thoughtfully and have dialogue about ways to minimize impacts to an important industry in the state. So those conversations and recommendations from those working groups were put into the roadmap, which outlines key strategies and actions for the state to undertake. And looking at the next slide, you can see the key objectives of the offshore wind roadmap. And this is really driving the work that we're doing, not only in the port side, but also building a supply chain in Maine. The modeling associated with the roadmap shows that we need 3 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2050. And so we need to develop a plan in order to achieve those goals. And so those are the key objectives. I won't go into a lot of the detail on your, you also have an executive summary of the roadmap before you and links to the roadmap, the full document that goes into a lot more detail, but that's a high level overview of the work before the Governor's Energy Office. And unless you have any questions, I can turn it over to Matt to talk a little bit more about the port efforts.
Are there any questions for the Deputy Director, Senator Leifert?
Thank you. So 12 turbines is the beginning.
So really, I mean, I think you can go back decade plus before I was sitting in this chair, but so the University of Maine has led a variety of efforts around building demonstration projects. We've had the Project Castine. We have other projects that the university is planning. The state has pursued the research array, which would be the first floating offshore wind project in federal waters that we are have an application before the federal government. We need a lease in order to pursue that project and then would work to build it. It would be up to 12 turbines, about 40 miles off of Portland.
What will that produce for kilowatts?
Up to 144 megawatts. And there was an authorization passed in the last legislative session for the Public Utilities Commission to review a power purchase agreement for that project.
Cost?
There isn't a specific cost known at this time, but the least possible cost to ratepayers and with the ability to construct and operate the project.
One more, if I could. How many homes will this take off from fossil fuels?
I don't have that at the top of my, in my head, but it's a very easy number that I can get you and follow up with you directly.
Thank you.
Representative Campbell, followed by Representative Woodsum.
Thank you, Representative. I'm hearing that New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and other states are really pushing hard to get ahead of us and to encroach on our opportunity. How aggressive are we going to be to make sure we get there first?
You're right that there is a lot of activity in other states, even beyond New Hampshire and Massachusetts, in terms of advancing the jobs associated, the economic development that will come from these projects. We are committed to working thoughtfully on the infrastructure necessary to enable the place to build these projects and the jobs associated with it. We have a significant milestones that we've outlined in the roadmap that we are going to pursue. We want to take a thoughtful and sustainable approach to this to make sure that we do it in the right way, but the time is now time to start acting to help build a plan that we've outlined here to achieve our goals and bring the economic opportunity that is before us. And we, Massachusetts and New Hampshire, we work well with in terms of advancing offshore wind and believe that there is a place for regional collaboration, especially on the energy side when thinking about how to advance these projects. But we certainly want to make sure that we have jobs in Maine from these.
What I'm hearing is they're very aggressive. And if they get there first, we lose out. Is that the case?
If we don't act, we will lose out.
And I guess another question. In particular, I'm pretty excited about the Lower Penobscot Basin and construction of these offshores in Searsport. How close are we to getting the construction site on the end of Sears Island, and what are the obstacles?
I might say that we can probably cover that, in Matt's presentation, so I'll defer that answer.
Thank you.
For that.
Representative Woodsum, did you have a question?
I didn't, but I will. I served on the EUT committee for several years ago. And I took a leap of faith and supported solar. And it has not turned out as I had hoped or as they had promised. And my concerns are, and I want you to take this back to the energy office and the governor, is that if this wind project comes off, that there will be very close scrutiny of the contracts and how the ratepayers are left with the cost. I know this is a very important project, and I hope it succeeds, but I honestly don't feel that the main people should be the one funding and paying for this project when we have multi-million dollar corporations and the government involved. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for expressing your concerns about these issues. I think it's important to note that there has been significant savings associated with the projects that were procured under the Renewable Portfolio Standard that the Public Utilities Commission issued in the last several years. And so this can have a downward effect on our rates over the long term. And so that is certainly something that we are watching very carefully in any effort related to.
Can you give me an example of the significant savings underneath the portfolio? I mean, if you can't, then I'd like to see it in writing.
I can give you in writing. I believe it's $68 million, but I'll follow up directly in terms of the most recent filing associated with the renewable energy portfolio projects. But let me follow up directly to confirm that.
Thank you.
Representative Dudera.
Thank you. Thank you for this presentation. How are we working to strengthen our grid so that we're ready for the additional energy? Is that something that we're also pursuing at the same time?
Yes. Thank you for the question. So we, through the roadmap effort, looked at a transmission study in terms of how to interconnect offshore wind projects, looking at our grid now. We've done several studies there, and then there's processes ongoing in terms of the grid planning effort with the PUC and other efforts to take a look at how we are going to need the grid of the future to achieve our decarbonization goals. So there's broader efforts there. Specifically around offshore wind, we are working with other New England states to pursue the opportunities for coordinated transmission, which means connecting multiple projects offshore as opposed to each project having its own radio interconnection cable back to the coast, and pursuing the opportunity, looking at federal funding associated with the potential for supporting a larger project. These are in the early stages, but I think that's the direction that we want to go, looking at how we can share costs and be thoughtful in minimizing impacts there. But we will continue to look at transmission planning, both in terms of onshore capabilities and offshore, and working with a variety of different stakeholders that are involved in that.
Thanks. So I'm glad to hear that, because when my good colleague here asked about the competition question, I'm also interested in the cooperation of the states. You know, we all share the Gulf of Maine. So how can the New England states in particular, you know, collaborate? So I'm glad to hear there's some cooperation happening around that. Thank you.
Senator Lyford.
Is it the intent to use the University of Maine's technology for offshore wind projects here in Maine?
We are excited about the University of Maine technology, and the state has taken multiple steps to support that technology through over the years. The Maine Research Array will utilize University of Maine technology. The federal commercial leasing, those areas will be auctioned by the federal government, and they will have the ability to determine the best technology based on a variety of factors that they'll consider there. And we know the university is looking to expand its work. So we're hopeful that there will be opportunities for the university as well there.
Thank you.
Representative Campbell.
Thank you, Representative. So we're hearing all these stories about soundings for a different type of not the floating, the attachments to the and the plight of the whales. And maybe you're not the one to explain this, but how does that technology or the problem that it's caused affect this particular plan?
You're right. So in south of the Gulf of Maine, they're utilizing fixed platforms where you have to pile drive to attach a platform and then have the turbine on top, and the construction can have noise associated with it. I want to be clear that NOAA has put out information about the recent whale activity that is not related to offshore wind activities specifically. I want to defer to NOAA and have that's characterized exactly. But in the Gulf of Maine, we'll use floating technology. And the one of the things that we want to look at is understanding what are the risks to whales and other species. And our understanding is that the risks are likely from secondary entanglement. So if you have a net attached, if the whale has a net attached, then it can get caught on areas of the mooring line. So that's one reason why we think the research array is helpful to understand how those risks are. Working closely with NOAA, Department of Marine Resources, and others to make sure that we have the data necessary to minimize risks to whales generally. So it's an important topic and one that I know the federal government is looking at closely as well.
So this is occurring in exploration, not actual construction. So what's the difference or the sameness between the exploration of the attachment to the ocean floor and the permanently attached structures?
Are you asking how whales react to the permanent structures in fixed bottom?
Well, I'm assuming it's coming from the exploration of the structure of the sea floor. And that's the same. There's the permanent structures, which have to be probably more stabilizing than a floating. But is the exploration to identify that attachment the same, and does it have the same risk to sea life?
Let me follow up to make sure that I get that answer to you accurately.
Just a question.
Representative Sobolewski.
Thank you. I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't hear the very beginning of your testimony, so if my question is not... it's not good for you, let me know. But who would be responsible for development and construction of the project?
So for the proposed research array, this is the project in federal waters. The state is partnering with two developers, Diamond Offshore Wind and RWE Renewables, to develop and construct and operate the project. For future commercial leasing, the federal government will have an auction for any lease areas, and interested developers can bid on those and then have the rights to plan and permit a project.
Funded by the government, not the state.
So those activities are just for their leasing rights. So a company will have the leasing rights separately. They'll be reliant on a state or private entity to have a procurement to then sell the energy back from those projects. So there's no commitment through the federal process in terms of who's buying that. Now, I know that there is legislation before the UT committee to look at procurement, and other states are also looking at procurement options for offshore wind.
But about the actual construction of the project, whose responsibility would that, whose guidance would that come under?
It would be under a long-term contract signed under the direction of the Utilities Commission. for a developer to do that. However, the federal government would be required to review the construction plans, including consultation with NOAA and other federal agencies, as well as roles for the state and some of the review of the project, but the responsibility would be for a private developer.
Do you know if the state will be requiring a PLA of the contractor?
So in the research array authorization statute that was passed, there is language related to project labor agreement requirements, and so that is in law now. In the roadmap process, we had a lengthy conversation about how to build a career supporting jobs in Maine, mm-hmm. and also recognizing that we want to make sure that we are having Maine people in part of these jobs, and how to balance that. And so we had many helpful open conversations about that, and that conversation will continue as we advance these projects.
Thank you.
Senator Brenner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here. So it's safe to assume that these federal leases are going to that the federal government will offer these leases out regardless of what Maine does. So whether Maine is participating or not with regard to port development or procurement. And so with regard to Representative Campbell's question about other states being more aggressive and moving forward, it's about making sure we have a relationship with these leases with regard to procurement and with regard to a port to be able to participate in the activity of construction and maintenance long term. So what we're essentially looking at is what's the roadmap and what needs to be put in place, because the economic development is going to land in some states' purview, and wouldn't it be nice if Maine was a player?
Yes, absolutely. That's the goal here, and also to do so in a thoughtful way, making sure that we have being part of the conversation in terms of where the projects are and how they're built. But if we do not act on this, we will lose out on those economic opportunities, and the federal government has committed to leasing. And so that is out of our control specifically.
Thank you.
I have a question, and thank you. This is really helpful. Thank you for coming. I know some of us on this committee and others in the legislature had the opportunity earlier this past year to take some field trips down to Rhode Island to look at what's happening in terms of offshore wind in the state of Rhode Island. Can you speak to where they might be at developmentally in terms of, you know, understanding that it's a leased project and that states will be competitive, where we kind of rank in terms of where we're at with what Rhode Island is doing? And then secondarily, if you could speak to the economic benefits in terms of labor and jobs that a project such as this would have as an impact for the state of Maine and on our economy.
Yeah, that's a really good question. One of the slides I didn't put in today is all of the activity that is happening along the East Coast. You're also seeing leases on the West Coast. And so there are several projects that the federal government has approved and are under construction, and that is bringing real jobs and the type and investment and types of you're seeing states and companies invest in port activities and workforce training and building out supply chain that is, as Matt will show you, large industrial space to build these projects. And so Rhode Island and many states are further along in having issued past statutory direction around procurements, issued procurements, building projects, building relationships, and bringing the jobs to their states. And so we are starting this process. We think that there's still a good opportunity to lead, especially in the floating foundation and floating space, which is new for the country. And this is why we're pursuing this. So why we're pursuing it. Thank you.
Well, in terms of the economic benefits, I know that it's identified in the executive summary to some degree, and thank you for that. But also, my assumption is that the jobs that we are referring to are not just construction jobs for startup. These are, and I'm sure that our colleague can speak a little bit more to that when you have that opportunity. But my assumption is that in addition to construction jobs, which is startup, these are going to be ongoing long-term economic opportunities for the state of Maine in terms of employment for the long term. Is that true?
Yes. So in for a project, you'll have a lot of activity around the construction, but there's also operations and maintenance, and where, and whether it be Portland or East Searsport or other places, can we have operation and maintenance based to have support these projects? We also looked at what companies are engaging in offshore wind now, and 80 companies are either active in the offshore wind space or interested in that. And that includes engineering firms, permitting, survey work, and other skills that people in Maine are doing, are using now to support the broader industry. We also want to take a look at what manufacturing capabilities, our maritime industry expertise, and otherwise, how can we help train and provide information to bring existing companies into the offshore wind marketplace, not only for the projects in the Gulf of Maine, but for the global trillion-dollar industry that's coming.
And just finally, and it's a little bit of a different tangent, but is the administration, to your knowledge, doing any kind of work in a more deliberate manner in terms of our partnership with, for example, the community colleges? And certainly we have a relationship with the University of Maine system, but what's happening up in Orono, but in terms of providing curricula and what have you for students that may be interested in pursuing work in this field? Or can you speak to anything relative to that?
Yeah, under the Governor's Energy Office, utilizing Maine Jobs and Recovery Act funding, we launched the Clean Energy Partnership. So holistically, how can we support community colleges, companies interested in labor unions interested in training the workforce of the future? We issued $1 million to $2 million grants to different entities, including the university and others, to provide curriculum, training, resources to build, to inspire our people in our state to take on these jobs of the future.
Thank you very much. Representative Sobolewski.
Thank you very much. The back to the PLA again, if I could. Is the state requiring the PLA as a state requirement, or is it to align with the federal government because it's a federal government requirement to get funding?
In the authorization related to the research array, there's specific language for a project labor agreement that's specific to the state of Maine. In the conversation around the roadmap, we recognize that the Biden administration is looking at project labor agreement broadly, requirements broadly in these leases. And so we'll be mindful of what requirements the federal government will take, and then take a look at that in terms of what it means to build these projects. So the roadmap language and the research array authorization are the two kind of documents that have been produced associated with this. But I think it's an ongoing conversation about how to build these jobs, build these long-term jobs, career-supporting, family-supporting jobs in Maine, and how to do that appropriately.
And they're kind of a double-edged sword, because out of the 50,000 that we have here in the state of Maine that work in the construction industry, only 10% are unionized. And our big contractors, Chimbro, Sargent, and whatnot, will not engage in a PLA. So that would be bringing out-of-state people into the state of Maine to work and take those jobs. What are your thoughts on that in regards to a PLA?
What we think is most important is that we are supporting job opportunities for Maine people, and that's what we want to pursue. And so we are, through the roadmap process, we had members of the unions, we had members of the business and businesses in on this working group to have that dialogue and to recognize that the majority of our existing companies are not utilizing those types of agreements. And so we want to make sure that we're pursuing this thoughtfully in a way that is sustainable for long-term growth, but also that we're supporting Maine people. So it's an important conversation to continue to have.
Quickly, is the PLA in the language, is it a requirement or a recommendation, suggestion type thing?
Just to clarify,
I've seen it both ways.
In what language?
In the state.
For the research array specifically, there is a requirement. There is other language in the state that it, so there's that. And
thank you.
Yep.
Seeing no other questions, thank you. And we will move on to the Maine Port Authority. But before we do so, we've been joined by our colleague from Mexico, Rosanna, if you can introduce yourself, please.
Good morning. I'm Tammy Simmershal Burgess from Mexico, Dixville, Hoffman, Canton, in Peru. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we will now hear from Matt Burns, Executive Director of the Maine Port Authority. The floor is yours, Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Representative Gramlich and members of the committee. Thank you for your time and for hearing my presentation today. My name's Matt Burns. I'm the Executive Director of the Maine Port Authority. And I'm going to give everybody a very high level presentation just on the work that I've been doing in partnership with the Maine DOT over the last several years on offshore wind port development. So I'll get right into it. So why does Maine need an offshore wind port? Well, there's several reasons really, but primarily a purpose-built offshore wind port facility or a marshalling port facility, which I'll get into the reason why it's called that here shortly. But that's what you need to support the development of the offshore wind industry. Okay. So if Maine really stands to benefit from this new industry that we've been talking about here for the last 30 minutes, we really need a port facility in order to fully take advantage of that. And what I mean by that is that those turbines that we've been talking about, those foundations, the actual erection of the wind turbine generator on top of the foundation, we would like all of that to happen at a Maine port and keep all of that economic benefit right here in the state of Maine, okay? So that's why we need an offshore wind port. We currently do not have a port facility that meets the criteria for offshore wind, turbine fabrication and construction. We currently don't have that in the state. We have three very robust deep water port facilities, Portland, Searsport, and Eastport, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. We do a variety of different cargoes there, but we do not do this fabrication and integration of these massive floating offshore wind turbines, okay? We don't have the necessary infrastructure to be able to do that right now. The other reasons why we need this is because this will help further our goal as a state to fight climate change, to provide renewable energy to the people of Maine, and just really allow the state to realize its climate and clean energy goals and also participate in the national climate and clean energy goals, which Selena talked a little bit about in her presentation. We also believe that Maine is has a competitive advantage with offshore wind, specifically floating offshore wind. And that's also like Selena explained, because of this history that we have of research and development with the University of Maine, the University of Maine floating foundation that we'll use in the construction of the research array. Those are the sorts of things that give us a leg up and help make Maine a little bit more competitive in that environment. So I talked about the characteristics of a port facility. So I'll get into a little bit more detail about what that is. It's really five major important things that you need to be able to do offshore wind at a port. So you need deep water access, 35 feet of deep water access or deep water draft at mean lower low water, so the lowest possible state of the tide. No overhead restrictions, so like no height restrictions. Obviously, you think about these massive turbines getting towed out. It would be an awful shame if they got tangled up with a power line or a bridge or something like that. So you can't have any of that. It's got to be an unobstructed route out to sea. You also need a flat, level, contiguous cargo staging area. You have a lot of components for all the wind turbines that are going to be delivered at the port facility. You need a place to be able to lay them down. You don't have delivery ships that are dropping off components every day. This is usually like a weekly or biweekly occurrence. So you need to be able to offload the ship and then be able to stage the components there. You also need very, very heavy loading capacity, not just on the wharf surface where you'll be constructing and rolling these structures out into the water, which I'll explain further, but you also need it in the uplands because you're going to be staging these massive components. So you need about 3,000 pounds per square foot loaded capacity in the upland area, about 5,000 to 6,000 pounds per square foot at the wharf surface. Okay. For those of you who are familiar with the International Marine Terminal, the container terminal in Portland, we have about 1,000 pounds per square foot on the wharf there. So I'm talking about something that's 5 to 6 times stronger than one of our largest marine piers in the state. We also need a dedicated wharf frontage. About 1,500 feet is what we envision or what we're conceptualizing to be able to do all the things that we want to do with this port facility, okay? So those are the most important characteristics and criteria of an offshore wind port. So what kind of equipment, what kind of structures, what are we actually going to be handling here? Well, we're actually going to be constructing and fabricating and launching these wind turbines. Well, I know some of you have seen some of these large turbines out in the western mountains of Maine. Okay, those on the grand scale of things, while they're very large, they're actually relatively small. Okay, when I started on this work, I guess in about 2020, I think the biggest turbine at the time was like a 12 megawatt turbine, which you can see is about half the size of the One World Trade Center on that diagram there. We're actually conceptualizing starting to design this port facility that we're talking about in Maine to handle up to about 20 megawatt turbines. So very, very large turbines from you know, the base of the water, the base of the foundation, up until the apex of the blade. We're talking about maybe 850, 900 feet tall, absolutely massive structures that we would be constructing here and putting together and assembling at this port facility. So just wanted to give everybody a sense of that, I guess, size. Another diagram that is useful, I think, that you'll see compared to the Statue of Liberty. You can see, you know, some of the, I guess, land-based turbines, like the 2 to 3 megawatt size, still very, very large, but still absolutely, pale in comparison to the larger, you know, 17 to 20 megawatt turbine size. So very, very large, very heavy structures. So what are the components of an offshore wind turbine? Well, really, you've got the nacelle, which is kind of the hub or the motor, if you will, where the power is actually generated inside the wind turbine. You've got the tower sections, which are the tall section that keeps the hub and the blades up out from touching the water or the land. The blades are the actual, you know, blades of the fan that are used to catch the wind and generate the power. And then, of course, the yellow structure that you can see there in the picture, that's the foundation. So that's either a concrete or steel semi-submersible floating foundation that can fully support the constructed weight and dimensions of the wind turbine generator. Okay. So in order to do that, it has to be a very, very large, massive structure. And you can see in this picture, it's a little bit difficult, but that large ocean going or anchor handling tug that you can see there, which is a very large tugboat, is very, very small compared to how big that foundation is. So just to give you an idea, I also have a table here that you can take a look at with some weights and dimensions of some of these components. You can just get an idea of what we're talking about here in size and scale. So I'll just talk a little bit about, walk everybody through the function and what's actually going to be happening at this port facility, okay? So I like to say that this is offshore wind in five simple steps. It's actually not simple at all. It's fairly complicated, but just to I guess, put it into perspective, there's really five significant phases. So the first phase is what we call the fabrication phase. So that's where that foundation is constructed. Whether it's made out of concrete or steel or a hybrid of both, it's constructed somewhere in the uplands, and then it's loaded out onto a floating asset, okay? So whether that's some sort of semi-submersible heavy lift vessel, semi-submersible barge, it depends on what it is, but it's got to be something that can get the completed foundation from the dry land into the water, so it's buoyant and floating, and then it can be floated off. So that's the third phase. So once the foundation is loaded onto the floating asset then moves into deeper water. It submerges itself until the foundation becomes buoyant, and then the two separate from each other. The foundation is then brought back to the berth, where the wind turbine generator is installed right there, quayside or at the berth, with a great big, you know, crane. And then once the wind turbine generator is assembled and completed on top of the foundation, it's then towed out to the installation site by two or three large ocean-going tugboats, okay? So that's how you essentially would construct one of these wind turbines at a port facility. This is just an idea of what one of these completed foundations might look like on a floating asset. This is a very specific type of heavy lift vessel that's used for large marine construction projects all over the world. These types of vessels are typically very expensive. So what we have been investigating is the construction of some sort of purpose-built vessel or the charter of some sort of purpose-built heavy lift semi-submersible barge or vessel that we can use at a port facility like that. But again, we're very early in that study, and we're still learning a lot about the methodology for launching and getting these foundations put into the water. But again, this is just an example that illustrates what that might look like. This is another example of a test turbine that was launched in Spain. This is the demo SAF turbine. I think it was like a 2.5 or 3 megawatt floating turbine that they demoed there and built a pilot project. But essentially, you can see exactly what I'm talking about. They've got their floating asset. They load the completed turbine onto the floating asset, submerge it. It's then brought back to the dock. So this is not something that while it hasn't been done many times in offshore wind, it's a fairly reasonable way to get these turbines launched and put in the water. So that is, of course, why we're looking at doing the same thing or trying to duplicate a system like that. I'll just touch real briefly on the types of offshore wind port facilities. We obviously, I mentioned a marshalling port facility. That is essentially what we're talking about with a port facility in Maine, but that is a facility where components can be delivered and staged. But also we're talking about floating wind. So we're also talking about the fabrication of the floating foundations and launching of those as well. It is slightly different for fixed bottom wind. I could go into a little bit of detail on that, but just in the interest of time, we're essentially looking at a marshalling port facility for what our hub facility would look like here to get us started in offshore wind in Maine. We also, I'd just like to share, there's also factory facilities. So facilities that are specific for manufacturing components, blades, nacelles, it depends. A lot of those components are manufactured overseas. As the industry develops in the States, those supply chains will be brought over into the United States eventually. We're already starting to see factory facilities end up here in the States. For instance, the Port of Albany has a tower facility. I think they're talking about a blade manufacturing facility in New Jersey. So those are things that will eventually start to catch up as the industry matures. I would see it likely that more factory facilities show up along the U.S. East Coast as things progress with offshore wind. We also need operations and maintenance facilities. The wind farms themselves will need routine operations and maintenance. There has to be some sort of shore base where those, you know, boats and service vessels, technicians and everything can kind of be based out of. And then you also have regular service operation vessel trips out to the wind farms. Those are vessels that will go out carrying crews that will stay out on the wind farm for maybe up to a month at a time. They have hotel facilities for all the crew members to be able to stay out there and do their maintenance. But those will be able to, those will have to come back and be home ported somewhere probably in Maine for Maine-based wind farms as well. So just an example of the different types of offshore wind port facilities. We're obviously talking just about this first marshalling hub facility, but there will be others that will be necessary as the industry matures. That is something that we've learned a lot about over the last several years. Just touching real quick, marshalling facilities, they tend to be about 50 plus acres in size. We're actually looking about 100 acre footprint for the facility that we're conceptualizing here in Maine. There's many commonalities between fixed and floating, but they are different. But you know, a floating or a purpose-built floating port facility could provide utility for fixed bottom projects as well. There is some commonalities between them. However, like I said, the big difference is with a floating facility, you're actually talking about fabricating and launching these foundations as well. So that is a big key component of it. Examples that you could look at just close by, the Port of New London, Connecticut, and the State Pier project is a good example of that. The Arthur Kill Terminal in New York is another one that's worth looking at. The Port of Esbjerg in Denmark, one of the biggest marshalling port facilities in the whole world. There would just be interesting things for all of you to check out if you're interested, to just see some examples of these things kind of popping up throughout the world. Another thing that I would also encourage everybody to look at is the recently announced Pier Wind project at the Port of Long Beach. It's like a $4.5 billion, 400 acre, massive floating offshore wind project that's now just kind of been announced. And one of the biggest, announcements for purpose-built floating wind ports here in the United States. They have a pretty impressive YouTube video that I would recommend checking out. But, you know, typically, this is just like any other marine port facility, similar to things that already exist in the state. you could expect maybe somewhere between 150 to 350 employees there full time, depending on what type of technology they're using. So whether it's concrete or steel foundations, it depends. So I'll just quickly touch on showing some examples of our port alternatives that we're looking at. We've really been looking at four primary alternative layouts. I'll really just touch on three today that I think are really in the running as being our alternatives that we've been really seriously considering here over the last year. We're looking at an alternative site on Mack Point at about 100 acres, the Sears Island, western side of the island, the transportation parcel at about 100 acres, a Mack Point Sears Island hybrid at about 119 total acres. And then, of course, we're also studying a no-build scenario. We have to quantify the impacts of not doing anything as a part of our NEPA process. So that is also something that we are including in that alternative list. But just to show you our sketch alternatives, this is the Mack Point facility. This is pretty consistent amongst all the drawings, so I'll just point out, but the blue area is the upland area. The green area is a fill area that is built out over the water. And then the kind of teal color is the key area that I mentioned. But three activities happening here. You can see along the face of that blue area, that light blue area, you've got the fabrication and launching of floating foundations. The middle berth is where the integration is happening when the wind turbine generators are being installed on top of the floating foundations.
Excuse me, Mr. Burns. Yes, Senator Lyford had a question, I think, about the previous slide.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem.
You were in that area. You've taken Eastport out.
Correct.
Could you give us an example why?
Yeah. So happy to explain on that a little bit further. We do still have work ongoing at Eastport. We have recently applied for federal funding specific to the Port of Eastport to further design and environmental work that's ongoing there. We have left Eastport out of the request for federal funding because in initial studies that we've done there on rock ledge removal, on getting the site prepped and ready for, developing a wind port, we would estimate over 6 million cubic yards of rock to be blasted and removed from the port. It would almost completely level and change the Port of Eastport in a very significant manner. So we have in turn started to direct some of our efforts away from there. As we continue to study that, we'll quantify that further, but we understand that to be a kind of an insurmountable hurdle with that amount of rock removal, that would take a very long time and have significant impacts on the port and, surrounding community. Yeah, yes, sir. Sure.
Excuse me, just another follow-up with Representative Campbell. Sorry about that.
So when you talk about Portland, too, you're talking 119 acres.
Right.
So is Mack Point and Sears Island about all we have?
It's a good question. So we have done some extensive analysis on, sites at a very high level to just see where we meet that criteria I laid out. So where do we meet that? And it's not in many places throughout the state. But furthermore, it's not in many places throughout the U.S. Eastern Seaboard either. So we have, at least we consider, a very significant opportunity just with the Port of Searsport and those sites I just mentioned there. So
that makes the Penobscot Basin happy?
I think that's
what I'm saying.
The stakeholder work is ongoing and it's very extensive. So that's something that we want to make sure that we get right. And we've taken, early and frankly, rather robust steps to try and make sure that we're engaged on that front. And we're talking to stakeholders and trying to get as much advice on site selection as we possibly can. Yeah. But I mean, I will say we're still very early in the process. No site's been selected and we still have a lot of work to do. This is a very big, very big project. One of the biggest, marine infrastructure projects we've ever embarked on here in the state. So we want to make sure we get it right.
Seeing no other questions right now, go right ahead.
Okay. So again, I'll just lay out these sketches. These sketches also are something that we are working on all the time. So we're working on these sketches and refining them, trying to minimize impacts in the layout of these. So that means reducing fill quantity, reducing dredge quantity to the furthest extent possible, and trying to just minimize whatever impacts we can. So, you know, these drawings as of today are the most recent drawings we have, but the next set of drawings that we have, you know, by June, you know, July timeframe will probably look different. But generally, we're trying to go for the exact, you know, same footprint, the 100 acres, the same activities that I described. But again, you know, minimizing impacts and trying to, you know, design this terminal or conceptualize this as a very efficient operation is our number one priority. This is the Sears Island sketch. As I mentioned, still the blue, the green, and the light blue area the same. But you can see that black outline on the outer border is the outline of the Sears Island transportation parcel on the right. On the left, that kind of dashed outline is the Federal Navigation Channel. So you can just see how the footprint is oriented towards the boundary of the parcel and also the channel there. And then this is the hybrid facility as well. I would just point out one difference with this is that in this arrangement, we're considering instead of a semi-submersible barge, the option of a inclined ramp to launch these foundations. I just want to point out that the methodology on launching the foundations is something that we're still studying and still learning about. We don't know what's going to be the most cost-effective or best way to do it, but we're studying both the barge and also the ramp options. So I'd just like to point that out.
Mr. Burns, we have another question from Senator Lyford.
Yes.
Thank you. While you're right in this again.
Sure.
You talked about, when we talked about CISPO, we talked about some federal intervention. Is the feds going to have a say on how this terminal is built? And
They will.
They
yeah.
will. So, they'll be so, part of it. So
that's
not
correct.
Only DEP, but also the federal.
Yeah, there will be a lead federal agency that'll be, you know, working with us through that process. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
And we have a question from Representative Briggio.
Should have asked this one earlier, but
no problem.
The cranes that will be necessary.
Sure.
How do they relate in size to the cranes at Bath Iron Works, if you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually don't know the total height of like their big, you know, construction crane there, but I'm willing to guess that these will be larger. Either about as large of a crawler crane as you can possibly get, or a substantially sized, you know, ring crane, which is something that, you know, is semi-permanent and kind of fixed to the dock, possibly as tall as 750 feet high to be able to set the, you know, the hub on top of the tower and be able to install the turbines.
Do you know how tall the towers are on the Verona-Bucksport Bridge?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think it's around 450 feet tall, but I may be wrong. I'm sorry. I wanted to use that as a comparison point, and I forgot to put that in my notes. But
okay, thanks.
Yeah,
Representative Campbell has a question. Do you still?
Yes. You're mentioning structures and heights. In my other life, when I sit on that end of the horseshoe, we've got a moratorium on structures 700 feet coming before us. How is that going to affect this, both in the structure being constructed and the cranes?
Yeah, so the cranes and the wind turbines themselves would certainly surpass that 700-foot height.
Well, there's some in the legislature that don't want it. So
that's my understanding, yeah.
You might want to talk to a few of those.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions at the moment, please.
Sure. Yeah, I'll wrap it up because I've been kind of going off here for a while. But just to give you an idea on timing, this is a very high level timeline that came out of the roadmap effort, which Selena explained a little bit about earlier. The first column on the left, well, I'm sorry, the second column from the left is the ports column. So you can just kind of get an idea. I would say that this generally is a pretty good indication at a very high level of what we're looking at for timeline. But, you know, you could see into 2025 towards the end of the decade. You know, the funding secured, we've finished and completed our environmental work, and construction is underway, you know, with completion sometimes by the end of the decade, you know, 2029 into 2030 is when we would expect, you know, a project of this, you know, scope and scale to be completed. So long construction, you know, timeline, permitting and environmental work will be significant. So this is a significant effort on the horizon for sure. But I just wanted to share a little bit of information on that. Talk about our next steps. We'll be continuing with conceptual design and environmental work, agency scoping. We look to meet with more federal agencies over the summer. We have an offshore wind port advisory group, which some of you may be aware of. That group will be concluding or having its final meeting sometime in this late June, July timeframe. We are going to be pursuing federal and you know, whatever funding opportunities we can possibly investigate and look into. And then also following and participating in the BOEM process to the furthest extent possible. As Selena mentioned, that the federal leasing process is something that we're very much keeping an eye on, because we are very much interested in you know, the commercial development of offshore wind here as it relates to port infrastructure. And then just quickly, just to touch on some of the permits at a high level, these are some of the permits that we envision, you know, needing to obtain throughout this process. And, you know, again, we'll be working with consultants and with our partners here with the state of Maine and also the federal government to ensure that you know, we're pursuing those responsibly and doing the things we need to do, you know, to the extent of the law. So happy to you know, answer any other questions before I turn it over to my colleagues with DEP. But again, my pleasure. Thank you for the time and for listening to my presentation. So
thank you very much. That was really very helpful. Any further questions? Representative Campbell.
Thank you. I'm really hearing a lot on the competition piece.
Sure.
Of the states. How aware are we of that? And how are we countering that to make sure that we're in the game?
Yeah, so I'm personally extremely aware, and I agree with you. I think that at least in the ports perspective, mm-hmm. it's extremely competitive. And we should be a little worried about that. But I also think that we are working on it. We're doing a lot of work actually to try and, you know, select a site and do the environmental work that's required and start doing things the way that the process dictates. But I also think that, you know, it's very wise to consider it from a perspective of competition. I think that, you know, one thing that gives us a bit of an advantage is that we, you know, are looking at floating wind. But I also think that the opportunities for ports to play a role in wind development on the East Coast are significant, I think, with floating and with fixed. I think that there is going to be a shortage of port infrastructure for fixed projects and for floating projects mm-hmm. all up and down the East Coast, which is why it's very important for us to be talking about this right now and be doing the work that we're doing right now to stay ahead of the game. So I'm very concerned about competition, you know, but I do also see, you know, areas where there can be collaboration. So maybe there's competition between the use of the port for certain projects and trying to make sure that we're in a good position for that. But I think there's a lot of collaboration opportunities for regional goals and for helping states achieve their goals, like in a collaborative way for renewable energy. Hopefully that makes sense.
So that's from the port perspective.
Sure.
What about the leasing and the distribution of units out offshore?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the leasing, I mean, I think just by the nature of it, it's going to be competitive. You know, I mean, I think the only thing we can really go off of is examples that we've seen. So Gulf of Mexico leases, the California leases. I mean, that's the best. I think more maybe North Carolina too, may be relevant. But, you know, there's examples that we can look at, try and draw conclusions from that to see or predict what things might look like here in Maine. But we just don't know. You know, I mean, we don't. That's probably a year out before those leases actually occur, maybe longer. So we just, the only thing we can do, I think, in the meantime, is just stay active in the BOEM process.
You know? So what can the legislature do to help?
That's a good question. I think, you know, as far as we're concerned, you know, we need everybody to, you know, be involved in the ports process, to be supportive of it. I mean, I think ports are the big key, at least for Maine achieving a lot of its goals, at least in my perspective, that's the case. So I'm throwing all the chips in on ports, you know, and that's how I'm approaching this.
So we're only here till July. What do you need from us?
Well, that's a good start. Yeah, sure.
Representative Schmerzel Burgess, followed by Senator Lyford. You're all set, Senator Lyford.
So am I hearing we might have a little advantage over the rest of them because we have some port that have been identified where maybe the other states are a little tight on land and.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like there's a lot of announcements, you know, all up and down the East Coast for offshore wind port facilities. I like to think that, you know, we have, you know, we have some significant assets, I think, that we are trying to make available and trying to develop. But I also think that it's a little too early to tell as far as my feelings on, you know, competition and seeing things kind of move right by us. I think we're okay. You know, I think we're in a good spot. But I also want to keep it going. I don't want to slow down. So, yeah.
Representative Woodsum.
Thank you. I haven't heard anything in this discussion on fisheries or lobstering. How is that tied in here?
Yeah. So, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm working on the port, you know, and I don't see a port facility like this as, you know, being anything that, you know, is going to necessarily conflict with fishing or lobstering, but it's also not going to be like a shared use facility. I mean, this is going to be strictly for offshore wind. And I mean, if it's a port that's developed or a facility that's developed in the port of Searsport, I mean, that's a commercial port and has been for many years. So I think that the way that inbound and outbound ships, you know, come in and out of there with the assistance of the pilots, I think they're generally very aware of impacts to, you know, fishing and lobstering, you know, entities and stuff that operate kind of in that entrance way into the bay. So I don't have any concerns about that or many concerns about that. But yeah, I mean, I think that as far as the overall concerns about offshore wind development, I mean, I've heard and understand a lot of those concerns. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, offshore wind doesn't really happen without a port.
No,
so that's what I'm trying to focus
on. Okay, very good. Thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions for Mr. Burns? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you all for your time.
Really appreciate it. And next, we will hear from the Department, Bureau of Land Resources, Don Hollowell.
Squeaky chair. Thank you. Good morning, Senator Brenner and Representative Gramlich, members of the committee. My name is Don Hollowell. I'm the licensing director for the Bureau of Land Resources at the Department of Environmental Protection. And I'm here today to give you an understanding of how an offshore wind facility would be regulated by the DEP under the current regulations. I guess the first thing I want to do is start off my presentation by telling you that projects located in federal waters greater than 3 miles offshore do not require permits from the state. There may be an opportunity to ensure consistency with enforceable policies of applicable state laws under the Federal Consistency Program. We are still looking into that possibility. So the turbines itself, that would be greater than 3 miles offshore as we understand it. But today we're talking about the port facility. So setting that aside, there is currently a prohibition on permitting new wind power turbines within state waters. This prohibition does not apply to an offshore wind research project, an already approved demonstration project, or an offshore wind port facility or transmission line. Within state waters, there are three general components of an offshore wind facility that will likely require permitting from the DEP under both the Natural Resources Protection Act and the Site Location of Development Act. That is the transmission line or the submerged cable that runs from the turbines to the shore, the construction of any onshore transmission infrastructure, substations, or transmission lines once connected to that submerged cable, and then the development of an offshore wind port facility like the ones you've just heard about. Taking a look at each of those three components, within state waters, the infrastructure associated with the transmission component of an offshore wind project will likely trigger the Natural Resources Protection Act. That's the submerged cable. The NRPA requires the submission of an alternatives analysis and the potential for compensatory mitigation for any project that alters coastal wetland. Just as an example, one of the standards under the NRPA, 38 MRS 480D, includes the activity will not unreasonably harm any significant wildlife habitat, threatened or endangered plant habitat, aquatic habitat, adjacent upland habitat, estuarine, marine fisheries, or other aquatic life. The Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, their submerged lands lease program would be consulted and would also likely require a submerged lands lease. Under that DACF review, it includes considering the effects of navigation, fishing, and other marine uses. For the onshore, the upland transmission component, an onshore substation or transmission line would require a review under the Natural Resources Protection Act. If it's located in, on, over, or adjacent to a protected natural resource, and Site Location of Development Act review if the project is greater than 3 acres in size, or the total project area exceeds 20 acres, or if the transmission lines carry 100 or more kilovolts. Those are the triggers for site law. Applicable site law standards include, but are not limited to, 38 MRS 484, the developer has made adequate provisions for fitting the development harmoniously into the existing natural environment, and that the development will not adversely affect existing uses, scenic character, air quality, water quality, or other natural resources in the municipality or the neighboring municipalities. For the port facility, like the ones we've seen today, that have both upland development and coastal wetland alteration, both the NRPA and the Site Location of Development Act would apply. Impacts to coastal wetlands require the submissions of extensive alternatives analysis and likely require compensatory mitigation. If dredging is involved, there are additional submission requirements that allow the department to consider the impacts of the dredging and the disposal of those dredged materials. Under the NRPA, the first standard is the activity will not unreasonably interfere with existing scenic, aesthetic, recreation, or navigational uses. Department Rules Chapter 315 further elaborates that the potential, and I should just pause and say, Chapter 315 is our scenic and aesthetic rules. And that chapter further elaborates that the potential impacts of a proposed activity will be determined by the department considering the presence of the scenic resource, which includes the Atlantic Ocean, the significance of the scenic resource, the existing character and the surrounding area, the expectations of a typical viewer, the extent and intrinsic of the activity, the proposed project, and the context of the proposed project. It's tricky. Similarly, the site location of development requires a development to fit harmoniously into existing natural environment and have no unreasonable adverse effect on existing uses and scenic character. The department understands that 12 megawatt turbines are approximately 850 feet tall when fully assembled, and that the crane used to assemble it is also 700 feet tall. It's likely that the department could issue permits for the submerged transmission cable, the onshore transmission components, the substation and the transmission lines. These are things that happen fairly regularly, and certain aspects of an offshore wind port facility under the current regulatory framework. The concern today is the tall components associated with an offshore wind port facility and likely the difficulty of those tall components to meet the visual standards of both the NRPA and the Site Location of Development Act. So I understand the public hearing you have next will address that.
Thank you, Director Hollowell. Any questions, Senator Lyford?
I asked Mr. Burns if the federal government was involved in the development of the port, and he said they are. So they and you will work together. Will you be the lead? Are there requirements more stringent than yours, restrictive? Any idea on those things?
Sure, that's a good question. There will be federal permits required as well as the state permits I just talked about. With projects like this, there is a lot of early and often frequent coordination between both the federal governments and DEP. We'll have combined meetings. The laws are not exactly the same, but they do parallel, which make it easy for us to coordinate and streamline the process as best as we can for applicants.
So you two get along?
We do. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Representative Briggio.
Thank you. That was great. So some years back, Bath Iron Works undertook a major expansion, involved dredging and filling. And I just wonder if you got any idea about what the scope of what we're talking about here would compare to that big dry dock expansion at Bath Iron Works.
That's a good question. I can't recall the specifics of that Bath Iron Works expansion. But from what I've seen presented here today, I think we're talking about something substantially larger. Is that fair?
Yeah, I wish I knew the details on that expansion project, but yeah, this is significant. Yeah.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Oh, yes, Representative Briggio.
Maybe at some point somebody could look at the size of the Bath Iron Works project. I think it's 20 years old, so sure. You'll have to go back a bit, but that would be helpful for understanding scope.
Okay. Yeah, 447 feet too was the observatory you asked, so I was 3 feet off.
Great. Thank you all so very much. This was really very helpful, and we really appreciate your time here with us this morning. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Yeah.
And
this is yours, right, Dawn?
Yeah. Okay. We're going to just take a little brief pause to get set up for our public hearing with Senator Curry. Yeah.